Good morning, everybody. I just wanted to start off by promising that I'm not going to speak about Italian neorealistic cinema today. Although I guess I just did. I guess it's like the story of the three monks who made a vow of silence together for an extended period of time, and on the first night, an attendant was walking by, and one of them called to him to turn out the candle. And the other one said, "You idiot, we're not supposed to talk." And then the third one said, "I'm the only one who has not spoken." So, like the Shishui said this morning at Samu, he was noticing some rough edges. And I was noticing it too this morning, and I was feeling that it was a type of like nervous, jittery energy once we first get into drop into session. And so maybe you have a new position or a new job or something that you haven't done before, and you don't know what to do, and it's okay. You are in a safe place. And actually being in that not knowing is the best place to be. When you are there, everything is really alive. So see if you can just settle into the not knowing. Settle into your body and see if you can reside in the not knowing and maybe stay calm and relaxed. And notice when you don't. It's actually a wonderful practice. Just think of how often in life we don't know what's going on and we immediately tense up and leave our bodies. So, not knowing is really an opportunity. So, here we are. First day of the last retreat of our summer Ango. And whether you've been up here for the whole month, or you're coming up for the week, or if you've been practicing in the city, it seems that it has been a very deep month of practice all around. But sometimes, especially when conditions are like they are today, it brings up a very serious question. What the hell are we doing here? It is so hot. Here we are sweating and stinking. What the hell are we doing? Are we masochists? Why do we come here? So, in reflecting on this month, it seemed very clear. At some point, it became very clear to me. I think the main reason that we come here. And we come here because we need each other. It's really that simple. We need each other. Of course, the center of attention for every week is based around our zazen and a lot of meditation. But if that's all it was, then we could just take off work, spend 5-6 days at home meditating 7 hours a day in the air conditioning. We could try it, but I imagine our private home session would have quite a flexible schedule. And actually the schedule that we have here, the schedule of session, is something that really supports us. The schedule itself, are you having a hard time hearing? Yeah? I hate to say it, but maybe we have to turn off the fan. No? Okay. I'll try to enunciate. So the schedule we have here is really a container that holds us and supports us. From the moment we first sit on the cushion, from the moment that we first came in here last night, when the silence began and the session began, we are in it, and we never leave it. At that point, the schedule has us, and we can just let go and sink into it. So we can feel safe in the schedule of Sesshin when we are together. And we really need to feel safe. We need to feel safe to go into a deeper place of seeing who we actually are. Our Zazen reflects off of one another when we're together. And when that happens, we can actually see more clearly our own selves better than when we are alone. And when we start to go to that place where we see who we really are, that's when we really need each other. That's when we really need to be together. Because sometimes that place can be very difficult to face. And I think that's the whole point. We are here. It's why we come here and sit in the sweltering heat and humidity, sticking to our robes, sticking to our cushion, sweat dripping, and feeling like a stinking mess. Some years up here we get softer, more gentle weather to deal with. But for some reason, the karmic conditions of things brought us quite a hot month this summer. So twice a day, actually four times if you count the servers and the cooks, four times a day we hear, "May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus." And maybe it's one of those things that we hear and it just keeps going by our heads, but maybe we could think about that. May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. The muddy water is what I'm really interested in right now. And when we really start going into the depths of this muddy water is when I really think we need each other the most. I think we all have experienced to some degree seeing very clearly the purity of someone else's lotus while they are in the depths of their muddy water, right? But sometimes it's very hard to notice our own pure lotus, especially when we're caught up in the muddiness. So we really need each other to be reminded of that pure lotus that we all are, and the muddy water that we all have, and that it's okay to be in the muddy waters. And we should feel safe to dive deeper into that muddy water. So we have all had the experience of telling someone that we're going on this session, Zen retreat, and they say, "Oh, you're going on a Zen retreat? I really wish I could do that. It sounds so relaxing." And we laugh because we know that session is a completely different experience from what most people's perception is. But it is absolutely relaxing in the end. I don't think I have ever felt as relaxed and as calm and at ease as I do after a session. But it's certainly not a trip to the beach. So 10 years ago, I was visiting Oslo, Norway. This is the beginning of my practice. And I noticed that there was a local Zen center there, and I called them up to see if I could join their sitting program one evening. And the person on the phone said, "Sure, come and suffer with the rest of us." Yes, it was a Rinzai center. And although I do believe the intention in his statement was one of pride, type of Zen macho, machismo, right? The tough guy sitting through the aches and pains and pushing through to enlightenment. But on reflecting on that in another sense, I think he's absolutely correct. Because when we start to navigate these muddy waters of ourselves, what we really get to is the core of our suffering. That first noble truth that Shakyamuni discovered long ago, that to be a human being is to suffer. Every single one of us has known deep suffering. It is part of being human. But the problem for most of us, I think the problem for most of us is that in life we've faced this conditioning that has told us in one way or another that suffering is bad, that it's something to avoid at all costs. So when an experience of suffering arises, we say, that's not me, and we tuck it away somewhere in shame and guilt, and we don't experience it. And in doing so, we don't experience who we really are. So here in Sesshin, we really need to hold each other in that place, in that awareness that suffering is okay. And although it may be painful when we first go there and start to experience it, it ends up giving us a feeling of liberation when we're able to embody who we actually are. And I don't think it is possible to do this alone. When we experience being held by the group, when we are in the midst of our suffering, it becomes quite an obvious thing to do the same for everyone else. And that's when true compassion and wisdom arise. In the study text from this month, Hongxi said, "Thus it is said, the mind ground contains every seed, and the universal rain makes them all sprout. When awakening blossoms, desires fade, and Bodhi's fruit is perfect self." The mind ground contains every seed, and the universal rain makes them all sprout. Every seed. And I only bring up suffering again and again because I believe that is the hard place to go. It's the place that many of us, in some ways, are unconscious to. We've become incredibly creative in our ways of averting the reality of our suffering. It's actually quite incredible when we take a step back and look at our lives that way. But if we can just let go of our incessant need to understand and name and categorize everything, and just go into our bodies, let our zazen be in our bodies, not in our minds. But notice when we are in our minds, notice when we are in our heads, notice when we're in our thoughts, and use that as an opportunity to come back to our bodies. When we do that, things will begin to present themselves to us. And we can just notice them. Maybe lean on them a little bit. Investigate them. Without the need to know them or understand them. Just let your zazen be in your body. Just reside in your body and let your mind wander off like the clouds and see what comes up. So it's very interesting when you're up here for the month, because we start things off with a session and we end things with a session, but in the middle weeks we start to talk. And what I've always noticed is that in those middle weeks of talking, a lot of feelings arise all around. People start getting a little more pissed off at each other, and things start to become a little more difficult when we start to speak about our experience. And so during precept week, Kaku Hoshi came up and gave a talk to our precept group out in the porch, looking at the text of Hangxi in relation to the precepts. And he said something that was really startling to me. It's very simple, but really startling. And he told us to read the words of the text as if we were hearing them through the ears of a little child. To really have a playful approach to a lot of these poetic passages, instead of trying to understand it literally. Same thing like I'm saying with the body. Just approach your zazen like a little child and see what comes up in your body without this, like, you know, big Zen student understanding of these texts, you know. Just let it happen and just play with it. And so in doing that, my experience this month has been extremely emotional. I have been brought to tears on many occasions. And that reminded me again of the first session that I ever did back during that last July blue moon at a Rinzai temple. And there was a point during one of the talks when the speaker spoke about someone who abandoned a baby on a mountain. And at the very end of the talk, he said very sternly too, he said that one of the main points of our practice was to have compassion for the abandoner. Not just the child, but also for the one who abandons. And after the talk, I remember running to my room and weeping for some time. I didn't really understand exactly where the tears were coming from, but I just allowed them to come and wash away what needed to be washed away at the time. So this month, the suggestion of listening with the ears of a child had me reflecting on the little boy that I historically used to be. And I remember a time, probably when I was about 8 or 9 years old, when my brother, who was 3 years younger than me, and I used to ride the school bus together every day. We'd walk down our long driveway together and get picked up by the bus and go to school. We would get on the bus and sit together for the trip until we got to school, and then we would go to our different classes. But at some point, after a while, I decided that I did not want to sit next to him anymore. And in remembering this, I tried to reflect on the experience and see why I did that to him. I mean, I completely abandoned him. He was like five, six years old. And I can remember in the haze of that old memory that there was an awareness in me of what I was doing to him. I can still see his little face, confused, not knowing why I got up and left him there all alone. Was it just that I was too cool to have a younger brother? I remember some years later, when I was an adult, hearing a friend of mine talking about his younger brother in a way of very high regard, calling his younger brother his teacher, his doctor, his spiritual advisor, even. And it really startled me. I had never realized that I could feel that way about my little brother. And I actually did. I mean, I actually looked up to him in many ways. I totally loved him, and he brought me all kinds of joy. But what startled me was that I realized I didn't think I was allowed to feel those things for him. Before this, I felt that I had to suppress those feelings because showing them would confirm a failure of sorts on my part. Who knows where I came from in the karmic scheme of things? I'm not completely sure. But it did not feel safe to continue sitting with him. And I completely abandoned him. I abandoned my little brother at a time, looking back now, that I think he probably really needed me. So here's a koan. It's called Baijiang's Fox. We know it. When Baijiang lectured in the hall, there was always an old man who listened to the teaching and then dispersed with the crowd. One day he didn't leave, and Baijiang asked him, "Who is standing there?" The old man said, "In antiquity, in the time of the ancient Buddha Kashyapa, I lived on this mountain." A student asked, "Does the greatly cultivated man still fall into cause and effect or not?" I answered him, "He does not fall into cause and effect." And I fell into a wild fox body for 500 lives. Now I ask the teacher to turn a word in my behalf. Baijiang said, "He is not blind to cause and effect." The old man was greatly enlightened at these words. So, in some ways, I feel like all of us coming here, in a way, are like this old man. It's like we come here, and in this jitteriness of the first day, we dip our toe in a little bit. And then we go back, and then maybe a few toes the next time, and then a foot. And then finally, when we are able to completely go in, it's like the old man staying. He finally decided to stay that one day. And at that point, ready to face himself. Then we are faced with the question, "Who are you?" And when we face ourselves completely, when we stop turning away and plant our feet in the muddy waters and really look at our lives the way we are, then we might have one of those aha experiences, like the koan says. The koan says the old man was greatly enlightened. And in his commentary on the koan, Hangxi said for that line, "Fox drool is still there." It's still there. It doesn't go away. It becomes a part of the whole. When I think back to this time when I abandoned my brother, in some ways, it feels like I've lived 500 lives since then. So many experiences have come and gone. So many people and places. Just think about 36 years ago, all that has happened in your life. And here I am, still carrying that memory, still haunted about what I did so long ago. I fell into a wild fox body for 500 lives. Are there any wild foxes in this room right now? So it's really no wonder that I broke down and wept at that first retreat when he spoke about abandoning the baby. And I think that that is the tough place to go and forgive yourself and have compassion. We all abandon. We actually all abandon all the time. We abandon whenever we forget the first pure precept, which is not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe. This is ceasing from evil. Whenever we create a story about someone, we are separating. We are abandoning. Or maybe we're so completely caught up in something, we're oblivious to what is right in front of our faces. Whenever we forget who we are, whenever we suppress our sufferings, we abandon ourselves. Whenever we fall into comparing mind, we abandon everything. We abandon ourselves and others. Whenever we notice how much faster someone else is at Orioki, or how much better we think someone else bows than us, or how much better we think we bow than the other, we are abandoning. And while it's easy to feel compassion and empathy for the parts of you that were abandoned, that's a no-brainer. Can you give the same compassion and empathy to the parts of you that do abandon? And we especially need each other when we realize this. Because this too is okay. This is what we do. Here we can experience the realization of these things. While we're here, we can experience it. And still, there is someone next to you or in front of you, showing you the compassion that you deserve, that you so often don't give yourself. And there it is, looking us right in the face. And at that moment, maybe we can drop it. And while the fox drool will always be there, will always be an imprint of what has made you, you, you are not blind to cause and effect. And you can let it drop. So this reminded me of a movie. Not an Italian movie, though. A Korean movie. Great, wonderful Zen movie that I think many of us may have seen, called Spring, Summer, Winter, Fall, and Spring Again. And in the movie kind of goes through the seasons of a person's life. And it follows this one boy who lives on this little... island with his teacher, the Zen master. And it starts in spring and ends in spring again. And in spring, in the first season, he's a little boy, and at one point he goes off into the wilderness, into the woods, and he decides that it would be a funny thing to find all these creatures, these little animals that he would come across, and he would tie a string around them. And on the other end, he would tie this really big rock so they couldn't move. And, of course, every time he did this, the master was somewhere behind him watching, like shaking his head, and the little boy was giggling. And so I think he did it to a frog. He did it to a fish in a stream, and he did it to a snake. And so the master, the old man, witnessed this, but he didn't intervene. He didn't stop it. And then that night, while he was sleeping, while the little boy was sleeping, the master tied a rope around him, and on the other side tied this giant boulder. And in the middle of the night, the boy was turning, and he woke up crying, like, what's going on? And the master came over to him and told him that he saw what he had done, and that the next day they had to go out and look for those animals. And he hoped for the little boy that they were okay, because if they weren't, he would carry them around in his heart like a stone. And so first they get to the frog, and the frog is okay, you know. The frog is just kind of like still trying to hop with this big rock attached to it. And so we freeze the frog, and the frog hops away. And then next he goes to this little stream, and to his surprise and kind of shock, there's the fish floating at the top, dead. So he frees the fish, and you can see the boy starting to be affected. And then they go to look at the snake, and the snake is just a bloody mess. The snake tried to wiggle itself free, and it just kind of sliced itself open on this rope, and it was just a hard scene of death. And the boy breaks down. And so it follows the boy through these seasons. So then he grows up and he falls in love with this woman, follows her, and then she leaves him, so he commits murder, and then he's arrested, and then after he's arrested, he comes back, and the old man has died, and he starts to go through this transformation. In the movie, it looks like he's practicing martial arts. He's like doing all these kicks, but then finally, what he does is he ties this rope around himself, and on the other side, he ties this big rock, and he goes through the action of climbing this really tall mountain with this rock tied around him, and he's wearing these flimsy little slippers, and his feet are bleeding, and in the end, he does make it to the top. And at the top of the mountain, he plants this Buddha statue. And the very last thing that you see is this Buddha statue is looking right directly at the little tiny island where he was. So I feel like this act of climbing the mountain with the rock tied around his waist is a little bit like what Ryotan Sensei was speaking of last night when he said that we need to put passionate energy into our practice. This was obviously a passionate act, what he was doing. And in the film also, they keep flashing back to these animals that he had killed as he's climbing the mountain. But I have to remind you that most of the time, the passionate energy here means softening. We can use this image of the man climbing the mountain with a rock tied around his waist, haunted by his past, right? In a sense, he was a wild fox. But when we do that on the cushion, we have to soften and sink into our practice. And the softer we are, the deeper we can sink into it, the deeper we can sink in to the muddy waters and truly face who we are. And just as Hangxi said about the fox drool still being there, you have to remember that there's constantly these images in Zen literature reminding of us of these dirty places in our lives. So we might first look at fox drool still being there as a negative statement and think he's saying that there's something missing. But it's the opposite. The fox drool is okay. Our lives are our lives. And what they are is this field of boundless emptiness which exists from the very beginning. And that field of boundless emptiness is also the muddy water that the pure lotus grows from. Empty field is not void of that. In actuality, It really needs that. Now, we are often reminded here in practice that there's nothing to attain, nothing to gain, right? That we will get nothing from this practice. And of course, that is all true. We try and chant that every day, and it is true. But I think that any of you who have been around doing this practice for a long time will attest that it truly does have the power to transform. In the years that I've been around, I've seen incredible transformation in those around me and also in myself. Life becomes softer, more spacious, less about you. And it doesn't happen overnight, but it does happen. Like Roshi tells us at the end of every session, we have changed. It is just a little change, but all the little changes add up over time. And when you turn around sometimes and see where you have come from, it may astound you. It's like wandering around on a misty night, and not until you have come home have you realized that your clothes are soaking wet. I feel that this practice has saved and transformed my life. And it doesn't end. We keep coming back. We don't ever grow out of it. It keeps going and continues to transform in ways we might never have imagined. And we keep coming back together, and we keep needing each other again and again. So I encourage you to really allow yourself to go where you need to go. Soften and let your body tell you. Your body always knows. Your mind is usually guessing, but your body always knows. And I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer talking about suffering and hard places in our lives to look all the time. Just remember that suffering is suffering. Suffering is not bad. It's part of being human. And in a way, we might shift a little bit and see that awakening to our suffering is something to celebrate. Maybe we can shift and just imagine in a different sense that we're in some smoky blues club somewhere, all rejoicing in our blues and suffering. Facing your suffering square in the face is something to rejoice, right? When a blues singer sings something that really expresses suffering, they say, testify, tell it, right? Otis Spann, the great blues singer and pianist, said, the blues is like a doctor, you know. It can heal you. So just switch out the word blues with suffering. And maybe we can think a little bit more like that. Like when the blues singer expresses their suffering with a big smile. Here's a blues verse that I'll close with. Good morning, heartache, you old gloomy sight. Good morning, heartache, thought we'd said goodbye last night. I turned and tossed until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn. Wish I'd forget you, but you're here to stay. Might as well get used to you hanging around. Good morning, heartache. Sit down.